This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And if this constitution, if this referendum actually passes, it will enshrine his anti-democratic changes into law, which will make it very difficult for Tunisians to contest his actions in the future.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, on Tunisian President Kais Saied's push for a new constitution that critics say will foster authoritarian rule. Details coming up. Also, Ivory Coast is demanding that Mali release 49 of its troops. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, a militia attack in the city of Beni killed at least 7 people last night. Beni, with a population of more than 1 million, sits near the border with Uganda. Authorities say they suspect fighters with the Allied Democratic Force, or ADF, carried out the attack. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in the Eastern DRC city of Goma says some of the scores of militias in the region also have targeted freight trucks, creating new problems for residents. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pondawson earlier today.
This morning, people in the neighborhood of Paida, which is in the Beni city, found bodies. But in the night, they heard some gunshots. And when woke up, they found 7 bodies of people, and many people were kidnapped. And this attack is attributed to ADF militia, Islamist militia from Uganda. And this attack is special because it's in the city of Beni, not outside Beni. It's in the city of Beni. And the last attack in the city of Beni was 2 years ago.
What are authorities saying about this attack?
Authorities are still reinforcing soldiers where attacks happen, but this problem now makes many other problems. Like, for example, since the last weekend attack, the Chamber of Commerce is the biggest federation of companies in DRC decided to suspend the importation and exportation of goods in the region of Beni because of attacks, as they are also victims of those attacks when their trucks are being banned and their drivers killed. So the situation made another situation of famine, because everything will be very expensive as we are not importing or exporting goods in that region.
Now, I understand that there have already been issues with trucks being attacked in DRC and problems getting trucks across the border. So is this new ADF attack in Beni going to make that situation worse?
Yes, it's not just this new attack, but the decision was made last week, as there was some trucks from East African region who were attacked in DRC, banned, and some Somalian drivers killed. Ugandan and Kenyan companies refused to export their goods to DRC or to send their trucks. And now DRC companies also join that decision. And this will make a rough situation economically in that region. For example, a liter of fuel was 3,000 Congolese francs in Beni last week, and this week is 6,000. So the price was doubled.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma. He spoke to my colleague, Kate Pondawson. Ivory Coast has demanded Mali release 49 of its troops who were sent to support a UN peacekeeping mission but were arrested on arrival and branded as mercenaries. Annie Rosenberg reports from Bamako.
Ivory Coast has released a written statement demanding the immediate release of 49 soldiers who were arrested at Bamako's airport Sunday, claiming they were unjustly arrested. Mali's military government has called the soldiers mercenaries. The Ivorian statement also denies allegations by Mali's military government that the soldiers were armed and arrived in Mali without authorization, and says both Mali's Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Malian Army's Chief of Staff received copies of the soldiers' mission order. Both the UN mission in Mali and the Ivorian government's statements have said that the soldiers were sent to Mali as support for a UN mission contingent. The UN mission in Mali, MINUSMA, recently renewed its mandate, with Mali's UN representative voicing the government's refusal to allow the UN to carry out human rights investigations during a June 29th Security Council meeting. The UN has carried out a number of human rights investigations in Mali in recent years, including events that implicate the French army as well as Islamist militants. The UN sought access to the town of Mora in Mali, which was the site of what many witnesses said was a massacre by the Malian army working with Russian mercenaries. Witnesses say the alleged massacre was carried out over 5 days. The Malian government has continually denied access to the town of Mora, saying the government itself would carry out an investigation. The regional bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, which includes neighbor Ivory Coast, sanctioned Mali in January over delayed elections, but lifted sanctions this month after the government proposed a 2024 election plan. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Laurent Musibaruta, a former Rwandan official, was sentenced yesterday to 20 years in jail. He becomes the highest ranking Rwandan to have faced trial in France over the 1994 genocide, in which an estimated 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus died. The French news agency AFP reports that a genocide survivors group welcomed the sentence. France has long been under pressure from activists to act against suspected Rwandan perpetrators who took refuge on French soil after the massacres. At the time, the French government had been a long-standing backer of the Hutu regime in power, something that has since caused decades of tension between the two countries. Laurent Musibaruta, a former prefect of the southern province of Gikongoro, persuaded thousands of people to take refuge in the Murambi Technical School by promising them food, water, and protection. Days later, tens of thousands of Tutsis were executed there in one of the genocide's bloodiest episodes. Rame Kamugira, a survivor of the Gikongoro killings, who traveled to France to testify in the trial, said the sentence against the 87-year-old Musibaruta should have been tougher. The African Union, an economic community of Central African states, says the Republic of Congo's legislative and local elections were well organized and fair. Rosie Piot reports from Brazzaville.
The African Union and the Economic Community of Central African States, or ECCAS, sent 50 observers from 26 African countries to observe voting in all 12 departments of the Republic of Congo. On Thursday, the observers released their findings, saying overall, Sunday's legislative and local elections were fair and efficiently run. Kwesi Awomezono, head of the African Union Observer Mission, said, however, there were some problems. He says the report shows there has been an improvement from 2016 to 2022. But he says the report also points out that there were anomalies, places where polling offices were not open on time, places where the delegates of the candidate were not present, places where the material was not distributed on time, which means that everything was not perfect, but overall everything went well. Gabriel Arcanjo Ferreira da Costa, leader of the ECCAS mission, suggested that the Congo Electoral Administration to implement certain recommendations for the future. Da Costa says the Electoral Administration will have to reinforce the capacities of its agents to master international electoral procedures. He also suggested encouraging more women, youth and people with disabilities to participate in elections. The results of the election are expected in the coming days. For VOA News, I'm Rosie Piot in Brazzaville.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Critics of Tunisia's President Kais Saied say his proposed new constitution would greatly expand his powers while weakening checks on his actions. Saied has hit back at the criticism, saying the constitution won't foster authoritarian rule and urging people to support it in this month's referendum. Saied's plans have divided the nation, with growing resistance from political and civil society actors demanding the return to an inclusive and democratic process. The president's supporters say he is standing up to elite forces whose corruption has condemned Tunisia to a decade of political paralysis and economic stagnation. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, discussed Tunisia's political crisis with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Kais Saied has really spent the past year effectively dismantling 10 years of democratic progress and consolidating power into his own hands. And if this constitution, if this referendum actually passes, it will enshrine his anti-democratic changes into law, which will make it very difficult for Tunisians to contest his actions in the future. The constitution is incredibly troubling for democracy supporters. It makes the president really an all-powerful figure, and there's no way to remove or challenge the president in this constitutional draft, effectively removing checks and balances. And even the lead drafter of the constitution has since condemned the version that Saied released, just showing that there's all sorts of red flags and really, really dangerous precedents for democracy if this moves forward.
Saied's plans have divided the nation, with growing resistance from political and civil society actors demanding the return to an inclusive and democratic process, while the president's supporters say he is standing up to elite forces whose corruption have condemned Tunisia to a decade of political paralysis and economic stagnation. What's your take on such a division?
I think, first of all, there is no question that Tunisia does face these challenges of corruption, political paralysis, and economic stagnation. But nothing that Saied is proposing concretely addresses these issues. You know, on the one hand, he is addressing political paralysis and removing the ability of other actors to challenge him. But that's not the sort of path forward that Tunisians are looking for. Nothing that he has put forward has any really ability to address Tunisia's economic problems and actually could undermine Tunisia's economy, because the actions that he's taking and that he's taken over the past year have actually decreased the trust of Tunisia's traditional donors. The donors such as the United States, Europe, and others are not eager to financially support a dictatorial regime. So the actions he's taking are actually more harmful to Tunisia than helpful at this point.
Tunisia's European partners have invested heavily in democratization and view the autocratic shift with concern, but they have failed to take any meaningful actions. With each new step taken by Saied, as you said, the path becomes harder to reverse. Is there any room for Europe and the U.S. to save the democratic transition in Tunisia before a referendum that could push Tunisia to total autocracy?
I do think that there is a small window of opportunity for the U.S. and Europe to act. No, the first thing that they can do, and they have been doing a little bit of this, is to make it very loud and clear what will happen if Saied continues down this path and if this referendum goes forward. they should be willing to put all of their assistance on the line, particularly for the United States, but also for Europe. A big part of the relationship is based on Tunisia being a democracy. There is also a high likelihood that if this referendum moves forward, it will not be determined to be free and fair. And so I think the United States and Europe should be figuring out now and should make it publicly known what the consequences will be if that actually is the case. Additionally, they should be supporting civil society organizations and the Tunisian public who's really fighting to maintain Tunisia's democracy.
But it seems that even the Western countries are not preventing IMF from proceeding and granting Saied a rescue loan.
The IMF deal is currently being negotiated. And what has been said sort of privately is that there is some political conditionality that would come along with that loan. If that's true, it's not likely that Saied will actually be able to meet the political conditionality. It's also not clear he'd be able to meet the economic conditionality that would come with that loan. So I do think that those conversations are happening behind closed doors between the US and Europe, who are trying to use that IMF deal as leverage. We've seen from the public statements since the Constitution draft came out that the US and Europe are very concerned, and they are very actively trying to figure out how they can be influential and what they can do to try to protect Tunisia's democracy. And I'm sure that the IMF deal is one of the things that they're talking about.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Southern European countries want NATO to address terrorist threats in North Africa. Anwar Bukars, a professor of counterterrorism and countering violent extremism at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says the situation is complicated with the redeployment of European forces, which he says constitutes a major strategic change not only for Southern Europe but for African migrants. Bukars tells VOA's Carl Van Dam it's not realistic to think the deployment of Russian mercenaries will be able to secure territory in northern Mali and the Sahel, where a militant insurgency has been on the rise.
They have the capability to monitor their borders and to protect, obviously, their territory better than most. But there are still fragile states in there, as you know. There's Libya, which is extremely fragile. There is Mauritania as well, and Tunisia to some extent here, right? So there are risks. There's no doubt about it for the Maghreb, North Africa, and by extension, Europe as well.
These numerous groups, including Islamist militant groups, as you've pointed out, have taken advantage of the Mali government's inability to assert control over territory in the north by continuously asserting territorial claims and attacking government forces and international security forces that have been stationed there now. Have these attacks and threats destabilized the neighboring countries too? And if so, how does that impact the whole relationship with North Africa and European countries?
To be fair, the destabilization of the region, started before the coup, right, and before the deployment of Russian forces. But nonetheless, the threat has deteriorated. It has has become worse since the coup. So there are risks, as I said. One of them is if you look at the mercenaries that have deployed there, and by this I mean Wagner. A portion of these mercenaries, if we believe the reports we are reading here, are Syrians, more than just Russian, operatives. And the risk here is that Mali, northern Mali and other parts of the country, might become again, a rare base for, violent extremist groups that might strike at North Africa, not just at the western part of West Africa. So there is that scenario here, right? Especially with if there are, as if we trust the reports, Libyans that are now fighting in Mali, and again, if we trust the report that there are Syrians and others. So there are risks. So even if the French recently in the recent months, they have neutralized several leaders of these violent extremist groups that have originated whether from Algeria, from Mauritania, from the Western Sahara and from Tunisia here. Most famous of which, as you know, is Abdelmalek Droukdil of AQIM, Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and Adnan Abu Walid Sahrawi of the so-called Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. So Libya is or could be at risk. And if
all these countries that you're mentioning seem to be at risk and destabilized in some parts of the country, at least, or others. Yeah. Italy and Spain in particular in southern Europe are urging NATO to do something about it. And of course, NATO is right now very transfixed on Russia's war in Ukraine, and that's had its impact too on Africa. Do you think NATO is ready to do something, is ready to act on these terrorist threats from Africa?
It depends what can be done. And most importantly, we have to see what the lessons that have been learned. And if you want to implement a counterterrorism strategy, we have to identify the shortcomings. We have to, you know, to assess the practices and security arrangements here. So there has to be a holistic approach to it, not just a military approach.
That was Anor Bukhars of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, who just returned to Washington after leading a four-day seminar on violent extremism for the African Union Commission and the 15-member African Peace and Security Council in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. The government of the United Kingdom has assured South Africa of help to end its energy crisis. South Africa's electricity infrastructure is failing, and national power company Eskom does not have the resources necessary to keep the lights on all the time. Eskom now rations electricity, cutting power to various parts of Africa's second largest economy in a process South Africans know as load shedding. Darren Taylor has more.
If UK Minister to Africa Vicky Ford wanted to witness the ravages of an energy crisis, she picked the right time to visit. South Africa is being hit with the worst and longest power outages since 2008. That's when citizens were first introduced to the term load shedding. It's since cost many thousands their jobs, with the economy bleeding billions of rands every time the lights go out. Some have paid a much higher price, killed in road accidents when traffic lights suddenly malfunction, or when the medical equipment keeping them alive breaks down because of power surges. Ford's experiencing blackout after blackout as she travels around South Africa.
It is so incredibly difficult for people. It's very difficult for businesses to plan their investments. And of course, when the lights are going out from the electricity grid, then many people are switching to diesel generators, which is really not helping the planet either. That is why it is so important that we get behind South Africa's plan to address this crisis and to secure the investment for the future.
Instead of fixing coal-driven power stations and gradually switching to renewable energy, a commission of inquiry recently concluded that Zuma and his allies in the ruling African National Congress spent almost a decade looting and mismanaging Eskom. Zuma and the others have dismissed the finding as a lie. Ford says South Africa has to end its energy crisis if its close economic ties to the UK are to endure.
We're very concerned about the situation with South Africa's energy network, which is impacting on its entire economy, on jobs and opportunity investment. The UK is the largest source of foreign direct investment into South Africa, and we all want to keep it that way. I want to see more investment coming, therefore more jobs, more opportunities. And key to that is getting a more sustainable and reliable energy network that is fit for the future.
Ford's stance is that South Africa has no choice but to move completely into green energy.
And what we've seen when it comes to renewables in South Africa is many UK companies wanting to invest, and indeed one of the largest investments in renewables in South Africa is coming from British companies through the $8.6 billion package that the UK helped coordinate. So we believe that through private sector investment, we'll be able to support South Africa in their work towards a just energy transition.
But given the ANC's track record and the findings of the commission, South Africans have every reason to believe such a move will be racked with corruption and that much of the UK funding will be stolen. Ford's careful to give a diplomatic response.
We will be wanting to make sure that, of course, that money is well spent and is spent in a transparent way that delivers growth and opportunities and that more stable energy net.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says his administration's dedicated to building that network. But at the same time, he's pouring money into keeping the coal burning, and his energy minister wants to go nuclear. The reality is also that some ANC officials have become extremely wealthy from coal contracts. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Thanks for listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Ihiyes Wuhib in Washington.